Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine today. The articles were published in November and early December of 2024. So I hope you enjoy the program today. I'll begin with this article from the Ideas section, The Great Grocery Squeeze, How a Federal Policy Change in the 1980s Created the Modern Food Desert, by Stacy Mitchell. The concept of the food desert has been around long enough that it feels almost like a fact of nature. Tens of millions of Americans live in low-income communities with no easy access to fresh groceries, and the general consensus is that these places just don't have what it takes to attract and sustain a supermarket. They're either too poor or too sparsely populated to generate sufficient spending on groceries, or they can't overcome a racist pattern of corporate redlining. But these explanations fail to contend with the key fact. Although poverty and ruralness have been with us forever, food deserts arrived only around the late 1980s. Prior to that, small towns and poor neighborhoods could generally count on having a grocery store, perhaps even several. The term food desert was coined in 1995 by a task force studying what was then a relatively new phenomenon. The high poverty, majority black Deanwood neighborhood of Washington, D.C., is typical of the trend. In the 1960s, the area had more than half a dozen grocery stores, according to a study by the anthropologist Ashante Reese. These included a branch of the local district grocery stores co-op, a Safeway supermarket, and independent black-owned businesses, such as Tip Top Grocery on Sheriff Road. By the 1990s, however, the number of grocery stores in Deanwood had dwindled to just two, and today the neighborhood has none. A similar story played out across rural America, following the same timeline. Up until the 1980s, almost every small town in North Dakota had a grocery store. Many, in fact, had two or more competing supermarkets. Now, nearly half of North Dakota's rural residents live in a food desert. The USDA defines a food desert as a low-income census tract where the nearest grocery store is more than 10 miles away in a rural area or more than 1 mile away in a city. A slew of state and federal programs have tried to address food deserts by providing tax breaks and other subsidies to lure supermarkets to underserved communities. These efforts have failed. More food deserts exist now than in 2010, in the depths of the Great Recession. That's because the proposed solutions misunderstand the origins of the problem. Food deserts are not an inevitable consequence of poverty or low population density, and they didn't materialize around the country for no reason. Something happened. That something was a specific federal policy change in the 1980s. It was supposed to reward the biggest retail chains for their efficiency. Instead, it devastated poor and rural communities by pushing out grocery stores and inflating the cost of food. Food deserts will not go away until that mistake is reversed. The structure of the grocery industry has been a matter of national concern since the rise of large retail chains in the early 20th century. The largest was A&P, which by the 1930s was rapidly supplementing local grocery stores and edging toward market dominance. Congressional hearings and a federal investigation found that ANP possessed an advantage that had nothing to do with greater efficiency, better service, or other legitimate ways of competing. Instead, ANP used its sheer size to pressure suppliers into giving it preferential treatment over smaller retailers. Fearful of losing their biggest customer, food manufacturers had no choice but to sell to ANP at substantially lower prices than they charged independent grocers, allowing ANP to further entrench its dominance. Congress responded in 1936 by passing the Robinson-Patman Act. The law essentially bans price discrimination, making it illegal for suppliers to offer preferential deals and for retailers to demand them. It does, however, allow businesses to pass along legitimate savings. If it truly costs less to sell a product by the truckload rather than by the case, for example, then suppliers can adjust their prices accordingly, just so long as every retailer who buys by the truckload gets the same discount. For the next four decades, Robinson-Patman was a staple of the Federal Trade Commission's enforcement agenda. From 1952 to 1964, for example, the agency issued 81 formal complaints to block grocery suppliers from giving large supermarket chains better prices on milk, oatmeal, pasta, cookies, and other items than they offered to smaller grocers. Most of these complaints were resolved when suppliers agreed to eliminate the price discrimination. Occasionally, a case went to court. During the decades when Robinson-Patman was enforced, part of the broader mid-century regime of vigorous antitrust, the grocery sector was highly competitive, with a wide range of stores vying for shoppers and a roughly equal balance of chains and independents. In 1954, the eight largest supermarket chains captured 25% of grocery sales. That statistic was virtually identical in 1982, although the specific companies on top had changed. As they had for decades, Americans in the early 1980s did more than half their grocery shopping at independent stores, including both single-location businesses and small, locally-owned chains. Local grocers thrived alongside large, publicly traded companies such as Kroger and Safeway. With discriminatory pricing outlawed, competition shifted onto other, healthier fronts. National chains scrambled to keep up with independents' innovations, which included the first modern self-service supermarkets, and later automatic doors, shopping carts, and loyalty programs. Meanwhile, independents worked to match the chain's efficiency by forming wholesale cooperatives, which allowed them to buy goods in bulk and operate distribution systems on par with those of Kroger and A&P. A 1965 federal study that tracked grocery prices across multiple cities for a year found that large independent grocers were less than 1% more expensive than the big chains. The Robinson-Patman Act, in short, appears to have worked as intended throughout the mid-20th century. Then it was abandoned. In the 1980s, convinced that tough antitrust enforcement was holding back American business, the Reagan administration set about dismantling it. The Robinson-Patman Act remained on the books, but the new regime saw it as an economically illiterate handout to inefficient small businesses, and so the government simply stopped enforcing it. That move tipped the retail market in favor of the largest chains, who could once again wield their leverage over suppliers, just as A&P had done in the 1930s. Walmart was the first to fully grasp the implications of the new legal terrain. It soon became notorious for aggressively strong-arming suppliers, a strategy that fueled its rapid expansion. By 2001, it had become the nation's largest grocery retailer. Kroger, Safeway, and other supermarket chains followed suit. They began with a program of self-consolidation, centralizing their purchasing, which had previously been handled by regional divisions, to fully exploit their power as major national buyers. Then, in the 1990s, they embarked on a merger spree. In just 2 years, Safeway acquired Vons and Dominick's, while Fred Meyer absorbed Ralph's, Smith's, and Quality Food Centers, before being swallowed by Kroger. The suspension of the Robinson-Patman Act had created an imperative to scale up. A massive die-off of independent retailers followed. Squeezed by the big chains, suppliers were forced to offset their losses by raising prices for smaller retailers, creating a waterbed effect that amplified the disparity. Price discrimination spread beyond groceries, hobbling bookstores, pharmacies, and many other local businesses. From 1982 to 2017, the market share of independent retailers shrank from 53% to 22%. If you were to plot the end of Robinson-Patman enforcement and the subsequent restructuring of the retail industry on a timeline, it would closely parallel the emergence and spread of food deserts. Locally owned retail businesses were once a mainstay of working class and rural communities. Their inability to obtain fair prices beginning in the 1980s hit these retailers especially hard because their customers could least afford to pay more. Those who could travel to cheaper chain stores in other neighborhoods or towns were especially likely to do so. Food deserts were not, by the way, a consequence of suburbanization and white flight, as some observers have suggested. By 1970, more Americans already lived in suburbs than in cities. Yet at that point, low-income neighborhoods had more grocery stores per capita than middle-class areas. The relationship didn't begin to reverse until the 1980s. Why didn't large chains fill the void when local stores closed? They didn't need to. In the 1960s, if a chain like Safeway wanted to compete for the grocery dollars spent by Deanwood residents, it had to open a store in the neighborhood. But once the independent stores closed, the chains no longer had to invest in low-income areas. They could count on people to schlep across town to their other locations. Today, in fact, many Deanwood residents travel to a Safeway outside the neighborhood to shop. This particular Safeway has had such persistent issues with expired meat and rotting produce that some locals have taken to calling it the un-Safeway. Yet without alternatives, people keep shopping there. In rural areas, the same dynamic means that Walmart can capture spending across a wide region by locating its supercenters in larger towns, counting on people in smaller places that no longer have grocery stores to drive long distances to shop for food. An independent grocer that tries to establish itself in a more convenient location will struggle to compete with Walmart on price, because suppliers who can't risk losing Walmart's business will always give the mega chain a better price. Indeed, during the height of the pandemic, when supply chain disruptions left grocery manufacturers struggling to meet demand, Walmart announced stiff penalties for suppliers who failed to fulfill 98% of its orders. suppliers complied by shorting independent grocers, who scrambled to keep staple products in stock, even as Walmart's shelves were full. The problem of food deserts will not be resolved without the rediscovery of the Robinson-Patman Act. Requiring a level pricing playing field would restore local retailers' ability to compete. This would provide immediate relief to entrepreneurs who have recently opened grocery stores in food deserts, only to find that their inability to buy on the same terms as Walmart and Dollar General makes survival difficult. With local grocery stores back on the scene in these neighborhoods, chain supermarkets may well return too, lured by a force far more powerful than tax breaks: competition. The Biden administration has begun to connect the dots. Alvaro Bedoya, a member of the Federal Trade Commission, has been an outspoken proponent of the Robinson-Patman Act enforcement, and the FTC, under Chair Lina Khan, is widely expected to file its first such case in the coming months. But Donald Trump's election casts doubts on the long-term prospects for a Robinson-Patman revival. Although the law has garnered support among some GOP House members, powerful donors are calling for corporate-friendly appointments to the FTC. Hopefully, the incoming Trump administration realizes that the rural and working-class voters who propelled him to power are among those most affected by food deserts and by the broader decline in local self-reliance that has swept across small-town America since the 1980s. A powerful tool for reversing that decline is available. Any leader who truly cared about the nation's left-behind communities would use it. That's the end of the first article. The author, Stacy Mitchell, is a co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, where her research focuses on economic concentration and the health of local economies. The name of her article was The Great Grocery Squeeze. The second article today also comes to us from the ideas section of the magazine, Journalism's What If Problem. Too many reporters are writing fiction, by Noah Hawley. When I was growing up in New York in the 1970s, the city was at its nadir: bankruptcy, burned out buildings, rampant crime. I started in public school, then switched to private in the fifth grade. My parents made the change because they said that if I went to the local middle school, I would be knifed in the halls. This was an act of fiction. I say it was an act of fiction, not because getting knifed was an impossibility, but because it was speculative, one of many potential futures. In reality, thousands of kids went to Intermediate School 70 that decade and were never knifed or threatened with a knife, though some were. In my house, the fear of that potential future was strong enough for my dad to take on extra work and make the change. As a novelist and filmmaker, I spend a lot of time thinking about the value of fiction. I tell stories to help me understand my world and the people in it. My job is to create feelings in the audience: fear and longing, joy and anger. When I consider the author's role in our culture, I picture the following sequence. First comes news, then comes history, then comes fiction. Novelists and filmmakers are the cleanup crew, parsing meaning from the historical realities we have shared. But over the past 10 years, I've noticed something at first puzzling, then alarming. Fact and fiction are trading places in the sequence. I first saw evidence of this phenomenon during the coverage of the 2016 Republican National Convention. Halfway through the week, a CNN anchor noted in an interview with Newt Gingrich, the Republican politician and former Speaker of the House, that violent crime was down across the country. But Gingrich argued that this was just one view and that people feel more threatened. The CNN anchor insisted, "Feel it? Yes, they feel it, but the facts don't support it." Without missing a beat, Gingrich said, "As a political candidate, I'll go with how people feel, and I'll let you go with the theoreticians." This was an early sign that we were moving, perhaps had already moved, from a fact-based world to a fictional one, where how people feel about crime is as real as the crime itself. My feelings, your feelings, everybody's feelings, are facts, and facts of equal value to actual reality. Crime is up because I feel like crime is up, and you will never convince me otherwise, because my feeling is a fact. Now, feelings, as I've suggested, are meant to be the purview of fiction writers. We construct our stories around the feelings of our characters. How they feel drives their actions. Feelings are not, traditionally, how we as humans understand reality, how we filter events into first news and then history. Those are assembled, in a perfect world, from actual facts, an objective recording of events that occurred. The motivations of the players matter, certainly, but the feelings of the reader, of the observer, how we feel about what happened in the world, cannot change what happened. Can it? There was one sign. Another was the rapid proliferation of alternative narratives. In the old days, when news happened, the media would report the facts. Two planes crashed into the Twin Towers, which then collapsed. Only later would conspiracy theories emerge. 9/11 was an inside job, for example. Then came January 6th, an event that unfolded as fact and fiction simultaneously. While the mainstream media showed us footage of Donald Trump's supporters storming the Capitol in real time, Fox News, other right-wing outlets, and social media told people that the riot they were watching was actually the work of Antifa. And so, before our eyes, the fictional version of the moment was born at the same instant as the reality. These days, MAGA's fictions focus primarily on the present. They're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats. And the past, a stolen election, stories of when America was, quote, great. But this process of fictional thinking is not restricted to the right. More and more mainstream news sources are also engaging in acts of fiction. Rather than the past or present, however, their fictions focus primarily on the future. During the 2024 election, that fiction revolved around what could happen if Trump were reelected. Dark speculation about all the ways in which it would bring the end of democracy. Early this year, for instance, this magazine published a collection of essays under the headline, "If Trump Wins." Now that he has, the speculation has only increased. Think of it as the opposite of fan fiction. Donald Trump, Tales of a Day One Dictator. A revenge fantasy starring Matt Gaetz as the Grim Reaper. As with many stories of the Trump era, this one has echoes of World Wrestling Entertainment, a violent soap opera populated with larger-than-life characters driven by grievance and a need for paycheck. Each new cabinet appointment produces speculation about soldiers in the street, 10 million migrants deported, Nancy Pelosi thrown in jail. Like my potential knifing in the middle school halls, these consequences are not impossible. Trump has, in fact, threatened to do all of these things. Nor are they even unlikely. But their exhaustive discussion, in the same sources that report the facts of the day, confuses Americans about what role the news media are supposed to play in our society, which is to report the facts and let audiences form an opinion. Speculation is not the function of journalism. It is what an anxious brain does, worrying about all the ways things could go wrong, sending the worrier into a panicked and angry state. The same state of mind, I would add, that consumes Fox News viewers. In the past 20 years, Fox has made billions off its viewers' anxiety, the fear it hosts inspire motivating those viewers to watch more and more Fox in a cause and effect spiral. In the online age, this is known as doom scrolling. You can argue that there's no equivalency, that replacing fact with fiction in the present is dangerous, while painting pictures of potential disasters is simply being prepared. My point, though, is not that news organizations are inventing the threat to democracy. My point is that when they fill their feeds with what-ifs, they degrade the exercise of journalism, turning news into gossip and journalists into pundits. This is not a new phenomenon. 24-hour cable news networks and talk radio were the original alarmists. But in a country where the news media itself are polarized between our sources and their sources, we should consider the idea that how journalists report the news may be as important as the news itself. And if the definition of crazy is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result, then journalists should examine the possibility that nearly a decade of resistance has had the opposite effect as was intended. After all, major news organizations have been warning for years that Trump is dangerous, yet he has only become more popular. The mainstream media may be trapped in an emotional call and response with the audience that escalates fear and anger at the expense of our shared reality. There is a larger story here about how algorithms push content with high emotional impact into our feeds, and how clicks and likes drive advertising dollars. That is a story about how news is a for-profit business. But to the degree that this is a story about how news organizations approach the job of informing Americans about the events and personalities of the day, I'm going to keep it simple and say that by using the tools of fiction to stir feelings of fear and anger, news platforms undermine the real value of their news and impair people's ability to consider it clearly. After all, fear, as the novelist Frank Herbert wrote once, is the mind killer. One day in the not-too-distant future, history books will be written about what actually happened in the second Trump term. Then the fiction writers will descend, looking for meaning, having meditated on the realities we've experienced, the truths we've uncovered. And if it turns out that we were all knifed in the halls, we will write about that as well. But until then, I think we are all best served by focusing on what is happening, not what might. That completes the article. The author, Noah Hawley, is the creator of the FX series Fargo and the author of the novel Anthem. His article was titled Journalism's What If Problem. I'm going to take a brief moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry, and I'm reading the articles from the online edition of The Atlantic. All of them were published in November and early December of 2024. I'll continue with this article. Your career is just 1/8 of your life. 5 pieces of career advice shaped by economics, psychology, and a little bit of existential math by Derek Thompson. Career advice is a genre that is almost fatally flawed. With 160 million American workers across thousands of occupations in hundreds of industries, saying anything that is of use to all of them is practically impossible. The most common counsel is almost always too personal to be broadly applicable. My toes curl with embarrassment when successful people say anything along the lines of, "Just do these three things I did." Autobiography is not advice. Given how poorly most people understand themselves, it's barely even autobiography. But in the age of quiet quitting and nobody wants to work memes, I've noticed that a lot of modern career advice is something more like anti-career advice. I'm ruffled by those who, having climbed the ladder with care and determination, turn around and claim that success is a sham and hard work is a sucker's game. Telling young people who just graduated from college that a satisfying career is hopeless until we dismantle capitalism is about as helpful as telling somebody asking for directions to the bathroom that no true relief will visit humankind until death. In this wobbly economic moment, I thought that sharing the best actual career advice I've come across might be marginally useful. This counsel is surely weighted toward white-collar knowledge work, although I hope it's at least somewhat valuable to any reader. Number 1. Your career is not your life. According to the website 80,000 Hours, the typical career is just that, 80,000 hours long. That's an almost unfathomable amount of time. But life is long, too. The typical person is alive for slightly more than 4,000 weeks, and awake and conscious for the equivalent of 3,000 weeks. When you do the basic math on 80,000 hours, you discover that the average career is roughly the equivalent of 480 sleepless weeks of labor. A little bit more math, and you realize that the typical person has 5 waking hours of not working for every 1 hour of their career. Work is too big a thing to not take seriously, but it is too small a thing to take too seriously. Your work is 1/6 of your waking existence. Your career is not your life. Behave accordingly. Number 2, explore, then exploit. In 2014, I reported on a new paper about young workers who regularly quit their jobs and ended up better for it. People who switch jobs more frequently early in their careers tend to have higher wages and incomes in their prime working years, one of the co-authors, the economics professor Henry Sue, told me. Job hopping is actually correlated with higher incomes because people have found better matches. Quit any job that offers a moment's frustration and everything will work out in the long run, was convenient to hear as a 20-something with a good deal of wanderlust. But I never took the advice. 8 years later, I'm still a staff writer at The Atlantic. This presents a bit of a pickle. I believe deeply in the value of switching roles to find the right fit, but I've never quit my job. Last year, the benefits of role switching crystallized when I read a paper by the Northwestern University economist Dashen Huang. In a deep analysis of the careers of scientists and artists, he found that their hot streaks tended to be periods of focused and narrow work, following a spell of broader experimentation. This is sometimes called the explore-exploit sequence. The idea is that many successful people are like good oil scouts. They spend a lot of time searching for their space, and then they drill deep when they find the right niche. When you put these pieces of research together, they cohere into a pretty useful piece of career advice. Even if, like me, you don't quit your employer, you should constantly look to quit your job, the precise set of roles for which you are salaried, and push yourself into discomfort zones. role switching is important, not because quitting is so wonderful, but rather because sampling from different skills and fields is helpful, provided that you're prepared to pounce on an area that clicks for you. Explore, then exploit. Careers are not the mere lineal progression of titles ascending toward the C acronyms, CMO, CTO, CEO. Better to think of your working life not in one dimension, but in two. The horizontal exploration of ideas, skills, and tasks, and vertical commitments to a single line of work that really fits. Number 3, don't do the job you want to tell other people you do. Do the job you want to do. Many years ago, I was thinking about taking a job at another company with a fancy-sounding title that belied the drudgery of the underlying work. By the way, beware this inverse relationship, as sometimes the most attractive titles are reserved for the most soul-destroying labor. I told my colleague, James Fallows, then a writer at The Atlantic, how excited I was to tell people at parties about this new job title that I would soon carry around, like a boutonniere on my lapel. "Don't do the job you want to tell people you do," he said. "Do the job you want to do." "Well, damn," I replied. And that was that. I turned down the position about 5 minutes later. The more time that's passed since that moment, the wiser Jim's words seem. Work is not a series of words on a LinkedIn profile. It's a series of moments in the world. And if you don't enjoy those moments, no sequence of honorifics will dispel your misery. Some people take jobs with long commutes, not fully considering what it will do to their health. Or they take jobs that require lots of travel, not fully intuiting what it will mean for their family life. Or they'll take horribly difficult jobs for money they don't need, or take high-status jobs for a dopamine rush with a half-life of about 3 days. If you want to be smarter about your beingness in time, either you can read a lot of impenetrable philosophy, or you can listen to Jim. Don't take the job you want to talk about at parties for a couple of minutes a month. Take the job you want to do for hundreds of hours a year. Number 4, be ruthlessly honest with yourself about what you value and how much professional success matters to you. Some people think about career ambition as a profound virtue. Others think of it as something closer to a capitalist sin. I think ambition is a taste. What does that mean? I love Central Coast California wines. They're important to me. But when I meet people who don't care about wine, I don't care that they don't care. Because drinking wine isn't a human virtue, it's a taste. Similarly, for reasons I'll probably never understand, I'm ambitious about my career. But some people aren't, and that's fine. The important thing is for people to be honest with themselves about whether they have a taste for ambition. And if they do, they should know that there is no substitute for working really hard and caring, contra the popular internet-y idea that hard work amounts to a kind of false consciousness, or that the word hustle is for dweebs. Again, the point is not that professional ambition is so morally pristine, it's a personal taste. And you should be honest with yourself if it's a taste you want to cultivate. Being stuck in the middle is agony. To be ambitious overall but uninterested in going above and beyond at work, or to be unambitious by nature and yet feel pressured to become a full-time workist. People are happiest when their life is aligned with their identity. Number 5. Flow comes from voluntary, difficult, and worthwhile work. The only productivity book that has ever made a lasting impression on me is Flow by the psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. He argues at one point that artists and other professionals feel happiest when their body or mind is stretched to its limits in a voluntary effort to accomplish something difficult and worthwhile. The best kind of work is voluntary. It's something you choose to do rather than accomplish under the imminent threat of poverty or getting fired. It's also difficult. Rewarding work is not easy, but an achievable challenge that requires stretching your capabilities and allowing for learning and growth. Another reason to explore instead of just exploit. Finally, it's worthwhile, which I interpret to mean that it's intrinsically rewarding. If you outsource your sense of worth to the feedback of crowds and the approval of peers and professional counterparties, your working identity will feel like a sailboat in a hurricane. You have to moor yourself to something that doesn't change direction every few moments, whether it's the confidence that you're helping people or the joy of pure discovery. Csikszentmihalyi's flow theory became an instant classic, in part because the word uncannily captures that gusher of crystal clear focus that pulls our attention through an achievable challenge. But flow doesn't come from doing easy things over and over again. It comes from tasks that reside at the edge of our potential. So don't be afraid to do the hard things. And that completes the article, Your Career is Just 1/8 of Your Life, by Atlantic staff writer Derek Thompson. The next article's title is The Hunter Biden Pardon is a Strategic Mistake. The blunder will haunt Democrats during the next Trump administration, by Tom Nichols. President Joe Biden's pardon of his son Hunter is a done deal. The president has not only obviated the existing cases against Hunter, the sweep of the pardon effectively immunizes his son against prosecution for all federal crimes he may have committed over the course of more than a decade. This pardon is a terrible idea, both dishonorable and unwise, in the words of the Bulwark editor Jonathan Last, and as my colleague Jonathan Chait wrote yesterday, it reflected Biden's choice to prioritize his own feelings over the defense of his country. But it also was a tremendous strategic blunder, one that will haunt Democrats as they head in to the first years of another Trump administration. The Constitution vests American presidents with the power to pardon anyone for crimes against the United States. They cannot pardon people for offenses at the state level. Usually, such pardons involve clemency for ordinary criminals. Occasionally, they include distasteful personal or political favors to friends, allies, and in rarer cases, family. Donald Trump, however, has promised to start the process of issuing deeply controversial pardons the minute he gets into office. Perhaps most disturbing, he has said he's going to start reviewing cases of the January 6th insurrectionists, whom he has called warriors and hostages, and to let many of them out of prison. Nothing will stop Trump from doing such things, nor will he pay any political price for such future pardons. All he ever cared about was winning the White House to stay out of jail, and he's accomplished that mission. But the Republican Party is now a wholly owned subsidiary of Trump World, and had Biden not pardoned his son, elected Republicans at every level would have had to answer for Trump's actions without reference to the Bidens. They would have had to say on the record whether they agreed with Trump letting people who stormed the Capitol and assaulted law enforcement officers out of jail. Although Trump would have remained beyond the reach of the voters, the vulnerable Republicans running for re-election might have pleaded with him to avoid some of the more potentially disgusting pardons. Forget all that. Joe Biden has now provided every Republican, and especially those running for Congress in 2026, with a ready-made heat shield against any criticism about Trump's pardons, past or present. Biden has effectively neutralized pardons as a political issue, and even worse, he has inadvertently given power to Trump's narrative about the unreliability of American institutions. Biden at first promised to respect the jury's verdict in Hunter's gun trial and vowed he would not pardon Hunter, and then said that because raw politics had infected this process, he had to act. And so now every Republican can say, when it comes to pardons, all I know is that I agree with Joe Biden that the Justice Department can't be trusted to treat Americans fairly. I'm glad he finally saw the light. Some people see Joe's pardon of Hunter as an act of mercy, an expression of a father's love for a son who has been through the hell of addiction. I understand those arguments. In 2020, I wrote about the relationship between Joe and Hunter. I also know that many Americans believe that Hunter would have been targeted by the Justice Department next year as part of Trump's Carnival of Revenge. I am less convinced about this, not least because Joe Biden could have waited until Hunter was sentenced for his federal crimes later this month and then commuted his punishments while fashioning a more limited pardon for other issues. Instead, the father gave the son a pass on any federal crimes committed during more than a decade of his life. And I fully understand that pleas about norms have little impact on Democrats who are tired of adhering to such quaint notions while Trump trashes them at will. It's stomach-turning to watch Republicans criticize Biden for this pardon after Trump handed them out during his first term like a guy spreading around drink vouchers in front of a casino. And besides, some might say, who cares about norms and the rule of law if Trump is back in power? The Bidens should get what they can get while giving Trump the finger, shouldn't they? I think anyone making these nihilistic arguments will come to regret them, but that's a discussion for another day. In the meantime, I am more worried about the Hunter pardon as a practical political matter. Biden has now hobbled an effective case that his own party could have made going into 2026, even against Trump. Most people understand corruption, and though they may not care about it very much, they don't like it shoved in their faces. Some of Trump's pardons could have been politically damaging to the Republicans. Just over a week ago, a poll found that 64% of Americans would object to pardoning those convicted for January 6th related offenses. But how do Democrats make that case now that Biden sounds so much like Trump when it comes to the justice system? Biden's statement on the pardon had a kind of Trumpian, unspecific paranoia to it. In trying to break Hunter, the president stated, they've tried to break me, and there's no reason to believe it will stop here. Enough is enough. Joe Biden is at the end of his career and angry at a political world that has made his son into an object of hate and ridicule. With the stroke of a pen, he saved Hunter and stuck it to everyone else, including, perhaps, the people who forced him to give up his campaign while Hunter was reportedly pleading with him to stay the course. Every parent can understand why he wanted to yell, "Screw you," into the wind before he headed out the door. Unfortunately, he may have also screwed many members of his own party in the process and undermined the resolve they'll need to defend the rule of law. That's the end of the article, "The Hunter Biden Pardon is a Strategic Mistake," by staff writer Tom Nichols. Our last article today is titled "The Fall of Aleppo Was Oddly Familiar" by Graham Wood. The fall of Aleppo this weekend surprised even the residents of Aleppo, so you can imagine how flabbergasted foreign analysts were from thousands of miles away. As recently as a week ago, the Syrian civil war seemed to have reached a dismal equilibrium. The Syrian government controlled most major cities, including Aleppo, and had ceased progress in retaking insurgent enclaves in Syria's north and east. A Sunni group controlled a microstate in Syria's northwest, which started as a little patch of Talibanism in the Levant. This miserable deadlock showed no sign of changing, but on Friday those Sunnis fought their way into Aleppo, and the government troops withdrew without much of a fight. Now the city is under insurgents' control, and no one is sure whether the government forces have it in them to stop the insurgency from penetrating farther south, perhaps even to Damascus. These events may have been unexpected, but they are also oddly familiar. 10 years ago, the northern Iraq city of Mosul fell to a Sunni jihadist insurgent group after the Iraqi army collapsed and then vanished. That group was the Islamic State, which had recently broken from Al-Qaeda, and like the Syrian regime led by Bashar al-Assad, the Iraqi government was close to Tehran. In both cases, the fall of a whole city seemed implausible until images of jihadists wandering around Mosul and Aleppo circulated on social media. In both cases, the incredulity of what had just happened swiftly gave way to morbid curiosity about what might happen next if the jihadists proceeded to the capital. Both cases, finally, share an underlying dynamic. Syria and Iraq allowed themselves to become tools of Iran, and therefore never developed competent states themselves. When their citizens rose up to object to a government that cared more about Iran's wishes than their own, the states were too hollow and incompetent to crush the uprising. In Aleppo, the Sunni jihadists are principally members of a group called Hayat Tahrir el-Sham. HTS is a descendant of Al-Qaeda, the mother group from which ISIS broke in 2013. Since then, HTS has mellowed out to some extent, having learned from the Islamic State's decidedly unmellow example 10 years ago. When ISIS conquered cities, it quickly instituted a particularly humorless version of Islamic law, began amputating hands of thieves, and slaughtered Shia. HTS claims to have given up jihadism, and their fighters have so far not soaked Aleppo's streets with blood or engaged in sectarian persecution. HTS's leaders have issued statements reassuring residents and rival factions that they do not intend them harm. One would have to be naive to think that HTS intends interfaith outreach to the eternally damned Shia, but their leaders have clearly evolved in their ideology. They have at least learned the value of patience, just as ISIS demonstrated the benefits of its opposite by galvanizing jihadism on a planetary scale. In both Syria and Iraq, the security of the central government depended on Iran, and because Iran is a Shiite sectarian power, the Sunnis ended up ignored, subjugated, or just plain shafted. In Syria, this shafting took the form of Iranian, Lebanese, and Iraqi paramilitaries wandering the land and killing insurgents and civilians. Russians joined in as well. Syria is a Russian ally, and Russia's Mediterranean naval base is the Syrian port of Tartus. Taran did not care about creating a state. It cared only about creating a proxy. And eventually proxies crumble. Because, as Machiavelli wrote 5 centuries ago about mercenaries and auxiliaries, nothing is as shockproof and reliable as a state army composed of citizens whose interests match their own. Iran never created a proper state army in either country, so there was a natural limit to the capability and dedication of those fighting for it. ISIS surpassed that limit in 2014. HTS has done so now. In the past, Assad, Syria's president, could rely on Iran to succor his country by sending Hezbollah from Lebanon or Iraqi militias, or could rely on Russia to supply it with Wagner mercenaries. But 2024 just isn't Assad's year. Russia has impoverished and overextended itself fighting Ukraine, and Hezbollah is busy nursing groin injuries inflicted by Israel. Proxies from Iraq are reportedly on their way to help Assad, but they too have other priorities right now, such as safeguarding the gains they've made by taking over the Iraqi state and its underground economy. Assad himself was rumored to be in Moscow recently, probably less to take in the Bolshoi's new production of Boris Godunov than to avoid becoming a Boris Godunov himself, dying as a rebel army approaches, or worse yet, a Muammar Gaddafi, skewed up the backside by a howling crowd. And with that, we've run out of time. That ends the broadcast. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I've been reading articles from the online edition of The Atlantic, dated November and December of 2024. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, then click on Demand. You'll see a list of articles available to you. Hopefully the one you're looking for is there. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.